The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Will Echevarria. I'm the assistant head library supervisor one here in the music department of the Free Library of Philadelphia. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. Tonight, we have author Aidan Levy in conversation with Nat Chinen. Nat Chinen is an author. We have here in our collection several of his books. Aidan Levy is also an author, and we have several of his books. Nate Chinen is the author of chapters in Lovers for Philadelphia, published by Ars Nova Workshop. Myself, among others, George Wynn, in collaboration with Nat Chinen, and is the author of Playing Changes, Jazz for the New Century. Aidan Levy is the author of Patti Smith on Patti Smith and Dirty Boulevard, The Life and Music of Lou Reed. All these books are available here in the music department. You can check them out. Please visit the music department here at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Nat Chinen is the editorial director of WRTI Jazz Radio here in Philadelphia. And Aidan Levy has a doctoral degree from Columbia University. And tonight, they are going to have a conversation about Aidan Levy's saxophone colossus, The Life and Music of Sonny Rollins. So we want to welcome Aidan Levy and Nat Chinen to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, and thank you all for being here tonight. What a joy it is to bask in this incredible book. I hope that a few of you have already sort of cracked into it and started reading. Once you start, it's definitely an immersion. And it's also just such a pleasure to be here with Aidan and to help him celebrate this achievement. It's really a remarkable thing. And I just want to have you all give him, before we begin, another round of applause for this book.
Thank you, Nate, and it's an honor to be here with you as well and to be celebrating this book in Philadelphia, which is a city that Sonny Rollins spent so much time in, and we actually both live right in kind of the Philly area. Well, I guess I'm a little bit farther out. I'm in Lancaster, but I've always loved Philly, so honored to be here.
You know, this book does so much, and we're going to get into some of the process and some of the details. But before we do, I want to talk about a relationship. And this is the relationship between you and the music of Sonny Rollins, which precedes, you know, any ideas about becoming a jazz writer or a historian or anything. So can you recall the first time you encountered Sonny's music?
Well, I had some allowance money, and I was maybe about 11 years old, and I went to the record store, and CDs were the medium at that time. Are they still? To some extent, yes. But I bought Saxophone Colossus, the album, and I started playing the saxophone a few years before that. I started on alto and then eventually migrated to tenor and settled mostly on the baritone. But when I put this album on my Walkman, like, my world changed. You know, just hearing St. Thomas for the first time, I mean, it was like before I'd heard that and afterwards. And I discovered Charlie Parker after that, but Sonny was really kind of my entry point into this music. So it started just as a fan and as a young saxophone player. Like you said before, I thought I would ever do any kind of historical work or write about jazz. That came much later.
And so it was the composition Saxophone Colossus that really did it.
Yeah. So
or rather the St. Thomas is what I meant.
Yes, yeah. Just the kind of synthesis that you hear between the calypso tradition and that swing rhythm that really just knocked me on my ear. It starts with, you hear Max Roach, and he just lays it down at the beginning of that song. And, you know, you have Doug Watkins, the bassist from Detroit, Tommy Flanagan on piano. Then Sonny comes in with that sound. And, I mean, you can tell instantly that it's Sonny, but his rhythmic concept is so infectious, but also so complex that you just want to hear it again. And on that solo that he plays on St. Thomas, the beginning of it is built mostly around like about five notes. And there's just a playfulness to what he's doing. And I mean, I just thought, this is so fun. There was just so much joy to the music. It was such a joyful noise. So yeah, I wanted to do that. By a coincidence, the last gig that I did in New York before the pandemic was at the Cotton Club with the Cotton Club All-Stars, and St. Thomas was on the set list, and the great saxophonist James Stewart turned to me and said, can you play a solo on this? And he didn't know I was working on this book, but yeah, so that kind of felt apropos.
One of the wonderful services that you provide in this book is a really detailed and thoughtful account of Sonny's family history, of the circumstances around his upbringing, and where he, you know, where his lineage comes from. And I hear that, you know, that moment that you're describing, that light bulb going off, I hear the eureka of that in the way that you tell this story, you know, and it's like connecting things that don't often enough get connected in the jazz literature around Sonny and carnival rhythm. And, you know, so can you tell us how you found your way into that narrative? Because there's so much there.
So Sonny Rollins was born in Harlem on 137th Street on September 7th, 1930. And he grew up in a West Indian family. He was the first person in his family to be born in New York. Everyone else was born in the West Indies. And his mother, when he was growing up, took him to calypso dances at places in Harlem like the Park Palace or the Renaissance Ballroom. So he was steeped in that calypso rhythm from a very early age. And his grandfather was a singer, and he grew up in St. Thomas, St. Croix, rather. His mother grew up in St. Thomas. And so he had that cultural heritage always in the background. And I don't think he knew at the beginning that he would synthesize that with what he heard in Harlem at the Apollo Theater, let's say. But eventually he did. He thought back to this melody that he had heard as a child that his mother sang to him. And he didn't even know the name of the song. So that's why he called it St. Thomas. But it was known by so many different names. Some people would know it as Carnival, or more commonly, I think it was known as Fire Down There. And Sonny was not actually the first person to perform or record St. Thomas. Randy Weston, the great pianist, had recorded it about a year or two prior to that as Fire Down There, and it was also recorded by a calypsonian who went by the stage name The Charmer, and then later became known as Louis Farrakhan. But the version of that song that we all know the best is Sonny's version. And I think it is that rhythmic concept that he had. It's that infectious rhythm in his playing, as well as, like I was saying, the synthesis of that calypso rhythm and the swing tradition, that he saw that there was a continuum there, he didn't feel that there was like a cutoff between them, that there was really a continuum. And that's always been something that's true for Sonny all the way through. But you can hear it in that one song in St. Thomas.
Let's take a step back and talk about the origins of the book. You've done biography before, your work around Lou Reed. How was it that you came to the saxophone colossus as your subject?
Like I said, Sonny was, that album was really the first album I ever bought. So many people have asked me about this book, like, how did you make the transition from rock to jazz? The truth is that it was actually a return in terms of books that I've been working on. But yeah, I also love Lou Reed's music. There is a connection that Lou Reed was a huge Sonny Rollins fan. And when the Velvet Underground reunited in the early 90s, Lou Reed actually skipped the release party for the album that they made to go and see Sonny Rollins perform at Carnegie Hall. So there was that connection there. They also both played with Don Cherry. But in terms of biographical research, the process was not entirely different for this subject. So there were still many interviews involved and archival research. Although for this project, I had a lot more time, fortunately. So I was able to talk to a lot more people and go to many more archives. When I was working on the Lou Reed book, that archive had not been processed yet. And with the Sonny Rollins book, I knew that the archive would become available at some point. And I had heard things from archivists that I knew, differing accounts. Some people would say, oh, it's really not that much stuff. And then some people said, oh, it's decent archive. And then when it finally became available to researchers at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, only a couple blocks from where Sonny was born, I must have been about the first person in there, if not the first person in. And I asked for the first box, and it was like a couple hundred pages of practice notes. And there are more than 100 boxes in this collection. So, it was staggering. It had practice notes, like I said, journal entries. It turned out that Sonny was a prolific writer. Correspondence, he was also a prolific letter writer. There was this idea that he was like reclusive, but he was actually just private. So he was always in touch with people. And all of his business records. So in both of those books, it was this challenge of how to organize all of this material into a readable narrative. But for this book, it was just much more material. And that made the challenge greater, which is why it took me 7 years for this one.
And when you for those of you who have not yet read this book, what Aidan is talking about is a density of research that is uncommon in a book about a popular musician. I mean, you read a paragraph, almost every sentence is informed by something. And the other thing I want to note, and this is, I promise, leading up to a question. You expect a book like this to have, voluminous materials from the likes of Max Roach and Elvin Jones and various other people from Sonny's public life. Then as you're in the early pages of this book, which is less documented, not only do you hear from Sonny's sister Gloria, for instance, there's a moment where Aidan is writing about an apartment that they lived in, and he says, oh, their neighbor, Mr. Mason. And then all of a sudden you're learning about Mr. Mason. So who was Mr. Mason? Just as an example of like one of these passing details that ends up like shedding some interesting light that I can't imagine anyone else would have uncovered.
Thank you for that question. Mr. Mason is significant to the story. And Sonny did not bring him up until I spoke to his daughter. So his daughter, Doris Mason, was Sonny's neighbor on Edgecombe Avenue, where he grew up in Sugar Hill, which is a neighborhood in Harlem that you might be familiar with from the lyrics to Take the A Train. You must take the A Train up to Sugar Hill in Harlem. And her father, Doris's father, Matthew Mason Sr., worked for the post office. And he was a supervisor in the post office. And he, according to Doris, at this particular post office, was the first black civil servant to work there who had a managerial role. And he was very important in the neighborhood, and he would be the arbiter of different conflicts that would happen in the apartment building or neighboring apartments. But the thing about him is that he was also a saxophone player. And he kind of shared a wall with Sonny, and he would hear him practicing every day. Sonny's known for practicing more than anybody, and this goes all the way back. Sometimes he would play in the closet so we wouldn't disturb the neighbors, but if you know Sonny Rollins, you know his big sound. So even when he was a kid, they could still hear him. They could hear him playing scales over and over and over again. And when I interviewed Doris Mason, Matthew Mason's daughter, she said, "God, we just got sick of this. Just over and over again. Another scale. There's Sonny again." And she said, "Well, my dad said, no. This kid is going somewhere." And he kind of took Sonny into his confidence. He was supportive of him when he was very young. And this meant so much to Sonny because his family was not supportive of him becoming a jazz musician. And growing up in a West Indian family, he was told that he had to play an instrument, but the idea was he had to play a classical instrument. He had to be a member of the orchestra. Sonny's older brother, Valdemar, was recruited by the Pittsburgh Symphony, and he played violin. His sister played piano and sang in the church choir, but Sonny wanted to be a jazz musician. So his family frowned on that, but he found support from this neighbor of his, Mr. Mason. So in the book, the idea was not just to throw Mr. Mason in there because this is somebody that Sonny met once, or you know, somebody that Sonny had a drink with one time and otherwise was kind of irrelevant to the broader narrative. It was that when I asked Sonny about this guy, he said, "God, Mr. Mason was so important to me. You know, I really wanted to visit his grave. I hope that his daughter knows how important he was to me." So when he said that, I said, "Okay, well, he's got to be in the book."
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I picked that name not at random, but there are a number of Mr. Masons in this book, people who are not in the canonical, you know, story. Now they are. And so this is part of what I'm talking about, this incredible gift you have for ferreting out this information and then weaving it into, you know, the story of this person, this artist and this human. Now, you mentioned Sonny is a private individual, and I've spoken with him a number of times, including recently enough that he expressed, you know, some trepidation about the fact that you were working on this book. Can you tell us about your interactions with Sonny? Because, and correct me if I'm wrong, he kind of didn't want to hear about it. He didn't even want to know that you were working on it. And then at a certain point, warmed up to the idea. And then you actually became quite friendly.
So Sonny is a private person, as you said, as I was saying. And when I first began working on the book, I was surprised to begin with that I even got the green light to do it. And I didn't want to move forward with it if Sonny would be opposed to the idea. But I could definitely sense some trepidation at the outset. And I thought, well, I'll just keep working on it and see where this goes. But, you know, he always, whenever we spoke, took the question seriously. You know, we always would have some discussion of biographical material. But at some point in the conversation, it would always veer off into spiritual matters. And that became the basis for our relationship at some point, was discussing the Golden Rule, which is something that's very important to Sonny, living by the Golden Rule. And he's starting a nonprofit organization now to promote the idea of living by the Golden Rule. But if we had a conversation, let's say it would be 3 hours long, I would say for at least an hour and a half of that, we would just be discussing his spiritual outlook. But yeah, in terms of building up a rapport, I really just took it one day at a time with this book. I didn't have any expectations. So I was surprised after I finished the manuscript that he wanted to go through the entire book, just in a series of conversations. This is in part because he didn't want to read the whole thing. I sent it to him in this binder. It was the thickest binder I could find at Office Depot. It probably weighed about 10 pounds or something like that, because I had to print the book out on computer paper and just mail it to Sonny Rollins, which was, I mean, I was terrified. You know, he read a little bit of it, but then he said, you know, I can't really read a book about myself. I mean, Sonny couldn't be in the recording studio that easily, and he hated to be in the booth afterwards listening to playback, so I can't imagine what it would be like to read a book that sometimes is a play-by-play of your life. So I said, yeah, well, let's just talk. We'll talk through the whole thing. So we did that, and he was able to make additions.
That's an incredible process.
Yeah,
it was. It's like an annotated oral history with like the source.
It was really fascinating. And there were many additions that I made after that first draft of the manuscript. Another thing I'll say about Sonny Rollins is that he became very interested in my cat at some point during this process. And what do you think my cat's name is? Of course. But here's the thing. The cat is not named after Sonny Rollins. I met this cat on my block in Lancaster, and it was a stray. And we thought about taking the cat in, but we didn't know how our other cat would react. And then our cat passed, and we went to a shelter and saw this orange tabby in this garage with a bunch of other cats. And I said, that is the cat that we met. And my wife looked at me like I was had two heads and was like, "That's you don't recognize this random cat." And then later that night, she was like, "You're right, that is the cat," because there was something special about this cat. And we went back to the shelter the next day and said, "Does the cat have a name?" And they said, "Sonny." So we were like, okay, well, that's just like divine providence or something. We took the cat home that day. And I told Sonny this story, and he was so moved by this that he always, every time I've talked to him since then, he's always says, how's Sonny? How's my little boy over there? And, you know, I've sent him pictures, Sonny the cat, like little photo albums of Sonny. That's not where we started out with the book. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm sure that you have similar kind of experiences because you did the book with George Ween. I mean, it's an incredible book. But yeah, like how...
Well, the difference is that I you know, George was a very willing partner and an eager collaborator. And I also, you know, lived with him for stretches.
Really?
Yes. And I was 22 when I started. So I was kind of, you know, that was fine. You know, mm-hmm. I had no reason not to basically embed myself with you know, the subject. You had a much cagier collaborator, someone with so much documented history and yet so elusive, you know? And so that's, I love that story about the cat because, you know, knowing Sonny a bit, I can only imagine like that's a talisman for him, you know? It's like, there's something like cosmic about it, you know? And I can only imagine that was just like, he's so tickled by that, you know? And it's sort of like a sign that like, oh, this is the right person to be embarking on this project, you know, clearly.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it was like a talisman, but he also just loves animals.
Mm-hmm.
And he has this reputation for being just this totemic figure of hard bop. And somebody who you wouldn't want to get on his bad side, let's put it that way. And when you look at any photo of Sonny Rollins, especially from anything before, let's say the year 2000, it's just like the paragon of a strong jazz musician who, you know, was virtuosic in what he could do.
And serious.
And serious.
Yeah. Like, although it's funny because, you know, you convey some of this. Like, he has a very impish sense of humor.
Oh, yeah.
And if you listen to the, you know, the full tapes from, you know, the Village Vanguard, you know, 1957 Village Vanguard sessions, and you hear his introductions, he's cracking jokes. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, he's a very, like, he's very warm.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Uncle Don. No, he's cracking jokes. His sense of humor is more important to him than almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wanted to make sure that that was evident in the book, that he even thought about, this is kind of some gallows humor, because he has a dark humor to him, but he thought about writing out his epitaph to say, you know, thanks to Mad Magazine and Bob and Ray for basically, like, you know, reminding us to have a sense of humor. That his sense of humor was more important to him than almost anything. That mm-hmm. when he was a kid, he was known as Jester. And he had that lighter side. He was always an animal lover. There's this whole series of photos of just Sonny with his dogs or Sonny with his cats, or he would draw portraits of this whole menagerie of animals, because he was actually a pretty gifted artist. He thought about being a comic book illustrator at one point. But I didn't include those photos in the book because there just wasn't room. But mm-hmm. maybe I will put them out at some point. I mean, it's just somebody who contains multitudes, where it was all there.
There's a good Instagram there, just Sonny Rollins plus animals.
Yeah, I've thought of that. There's one great photo of Sonny's cat. He had this kitten, and I guess he took a photo of the cat in front of his two Grammys, just sleeping, blocking out the Grammys.
Back to that reputation for seriousness. You know, before we go to questions, I feel like I have to at least ask one about what's become maybe the most, you know, single famous data point about this man, which is stepping away from the scene at what would, you know, seem to be the height of his prominence, his productivity. So the bridge, right, which was one of several hiatuses that he took. You get into this in the book, but can you tell us why you think this gesture has been so resonant for people for so long?
So Sonny has always been his own worst critic. And in 1959, when he stepped away from the jazz scene, he had finally risen to the top of the heap. He had won over the critical establishment. He was winning all the jazz polls in the US and in Europe. And this was really before the ascendancy of John Coltrane. So Sonny Rollins was considered the boss, in a sense. But he didn't believe the hype. And something that Sonny has always felt is that if critics thought he sounded great when he knew he wasn't sounding good, how could he trust them when they said he was sounding bad?
Mm-hmm.
So in this moment, when he was commanding really a top rate as a musician, and he'd finally won over his early critics, because he had early critics in the early 50s. He didn't just burst onto the scene as the Sonny Rollins. He made this shocking decision to vanish, and you could still vanish at that time. He had the support of his wife, Lucille, who was working as an administrative assistant at NYU, and he still had some royalties coming in, although not as much as you might think for some of these classic records. And he was looking for a place to practice. So at first he was practicing in his apartment at 400 Grand Street on the Lower East Side, but he was worried that he was disturbing his neighbors once again, just like with Mr. Mason when he was a kid. And Sonny practiced more than anybody, so he would practice like all through the night. And one day he was out walking and he saw the Williamsburg Bridge and the pedestrian walkway going up to it. And he went up there and thought, this is the perfect woodshed, which is the term that the jazz musicians would use for where they might do all their practicing, to go in the woodshed, to do some shedding. It also became a place to shed, as in like a second skin. So he was working on his mental health, his physical health, his spiritual health. He was doing chin-ups out on the Williamsburg Bridge, and it was the Williamsburg Bridge, not the Brooklyn Bridge, as many people thought. Yeah, this is this. It was just so surprising to everybody. They didn't know where he was. When I've thought about this period, the bridge sabbatical, what occurred to me, and I don't know if I even quite articulate this in the book, is it's a legend, it's a jazz legend that gave us, for example, Bleeding Gums Murphy, the character in The Simpsons, who's inspired by Sonny Rollins and the bridge sabbatical. But like, what is a legend? A legend is basically a prodigious feat of some kind, usually. That's kind of how we think of it. But what is this a feat of? It's really a feat of practicing more than anybody that you've ever heard of, that he would be up there, rain, sleet, or snow, for about 15, 16 hours a day. And I think about other figures that followed, like Simone Biles taking a sabbatical from gymnastics competition, or Naomi Osaka taking a sabbatical from the tennis world. And I feel like, wow, like Sonny kind of set that precedent. And it's something that is so inexplicable to people whenever it happens, whenever somebody steps back and says, okay, I'm not doing this anymore. You can throw whatever amount of money at me you want, but no, I need to take a break. But in the context of Sonny's life story, it made sense. He needed to take a break for many reasons. He needed to get right with himself. So I think it's a powerful legend. And I also think that demystifying it only, kind of exalts that legend even more.
Mm-hmm. There's a line in Ben Ratliff's review of your book in the New York Times in which he refers to that very thing. He says, you know, reading Levy's account of this period, you think to yourself, I would probably have made the same decision. At least I would have if I were Sonny Rollins, which is a wonderful way to put it. You know, this idea of, you know, at this point, we have spent enough time in the presence of this person to understand the motivations and the, you know, just the nature of that decision and how immensely sensible it is in the context of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to think about, you know, subsequent retreats from the scene, you know, including a lengthy one at an ashram. People talk about practice often in spiritual terms. You know, mm-hmm. you work on your spiritual practice. And it seems to me that this, and this is something that he has in common with John Coltrane, right?
Absolutely.
The pursuit of something, you know, working on yourself, there's not an end point. It's this kind of eternally renewing process. And he keeps doing that. He keeps checking in on himself. He keeps doing it. And it's one of the things that I know has been most difficult in this late phase of his life, that he no longer has that comfort and that an outlet for his conviction that has been with him since he was a boy.
Right. That there is that sense of spiritual or devotional practice that's always been present in his work going all the way back. And, you know, his grandmother introduced him to gospel music and to the sanctified church. He lived with a gospel family in Chicago for a while. And so he always had that spiritual bent in him. And when he went to India, at first, the Swami who ran the ashram that he found was not there, but eventually he returned, this guy named Chinmayananda. And he was able to meet with Chinmayananda, and Sonny wanted to connect his music to that spiritual practice. And he said, you know, Sonny, when you're practicing, that's really a form of meditation. And I think what you're getting at here, and I mean, I think it's spot on, is that now that Sonny's unable to play the saxophone anymore, he doesn't have a material outlet for that spiritual practice. It's kind of ascended to the purely spiritual realm. And this is for about the past 10 years now. So although I know he is feeling positive in his spiritual outlook, I think it took him a long time to get there, of not having that refuge in the material world for what he was doing spiritually. And so that's kind of where Sonny Rollins seems to be at right now.
So we want to make sure to make time for questions from the audience. So please raise your hand if you have one, and someone will be with you in a moment.
Hey, thanks a lot. Like you guys had mentioned, that hiatus was always like an almost like an urban legend. I had heard initially that he had heard Coltrane, and it's like kind of blew his mind. So he had to go back and, you know, to the drawing board, so to speak. But wasn't there also a period where Sonny actually stopped recording for an extended amount of time?
Well, yeah, during this period as well. So he wasn't making any public appearances, and he also wasn't recording. And he did this several times.
Okay. Because from what I had, they had a recording that came out, I think it's Stockholm. It was one of the set, so a box set that recently came out, and I was reading in the liner notes where he had just stopped, this was long after that, but he had just kind of not did any record, didn't go in the studio, period. He still was, I think, performing, but this didn't go up until about 70 or so. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, in terms of Stockholm, there is a recording in 1959 that was recorded in Europe. And this was his first tour of Europe before he took that hiatus or that sabbatical. And this is when his dissatisfaction began to grow. It was right when he'd reached this peak. He was a major touring artist, and he was in Europe for the first time playing the biggest concert halls. And he decided it was time to take a break, and he wouldn't go back in the recording studio. There were these rumors that were started that, like, Coltrane threw Sonny under the bridge. but, I mean, that couldn't really be farther from the truth. Because, firstly, Sonny Rollins, although he was a few years younger than Coltrane, had the greater reputation at that time. And Sonny took that sabbatical before Coltrane released Giant Steps. So it was Sonny Rollins who invited Coltrane to appear on Tenor Madness. It wasn't the other way around or something like that. Sonny was known as this prodigy, and Coltrane, I guess we could say, was a little more of a late bloomer. Although, I mean, I love Coltrane, and if you listen to Coltrane all the way back, I mean, you can hear his genius. But the idea that Coltrane scared Sonny off really wasn't what it was. They did have a friendly rivalry where they pushed each other on and inspired each other to go deeper into their own singular voice. But they were really like brothers, and they had this spiritual connection, like Nate was saying. There's a book called Autobiography of a Yogi by the author is a Yogananda, and Sonny recommended that to Coltrane. Coltrane recommended some books to Sonny. So they had a musical connection, and they also had a spiritual connection. Also, for a time in 1959, Freddie Hubbard was practicing with both of them in their apartments, and he would always show up at, you know, Coltrane's, and Coltrane would say, what's Sonny working on?
Yeah.
So they were, we'd get reports from Freddie Hubbard.
All right. Thank you both for this great conversation, and congratulations on your achievement. Amazing. 7 years. Wow. It sounds like the spirituality is so central to this whole equation for Sonny and your project, learning about him. And I was curious, you know, you mentioned the golden rule. Was there another kernel of insight that he shared with you that you carry in your own life spiritually?
Thanks for that. I mean, for Sonny, it really all came back to the golden rule, and still does. So he practices what you might think of as a kind of religious syncretism, where he's kind of borrowing the best from a variety of religious traditions. But whenever I've talked to him about it, he's always said, you know, when I study Vedanta, or if I think about the Bible, or whatever it is, it always comes back to the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And so that became a kind of just all-encompassing credo for Sonny. And that's something that I guess I've tried to carry and have thought more about since I began on this, since I embarked on this project, was just to always bear it in mind and, you know, to really try to make the most just and compassionate decision in any situation, which is what I see Sonny doing and what I saw him doing over the course of his life as I worked on this book, that there was this journey where he wasn't always living up to as high of a standard, and he felt that way and he still feels that way. But the notion was to continue trying to improve yourself, to always to live with that spiritual mindset and to keep your focus on the bigger picture. That's what Sonny's always talking about, is the bigger picture and the little picture. I think this is something that you see borne out in his music as well, and I go into that in the book. But yeah, I mean, he also just, he never got a big head, even though, I mean, he's the greatest living improviser. He was always focused on, you know, how could he do better? Not thinking that he's the greatest. You know, he played with Charlie Parker. You should have heard Coleman Hawkins, you know.
You know, if you were a musician and you had the discography that he had, wouldn't you be tempted to revisit some of it sometime? You know, and he once told me that listening to himself on record is torture. He said, it's like Abu Ghraib.
It's a great quote.
Thank you for the book. I know you probably get to this in page like 500, but I wanted to know, what was Sonny Rollins' reaction to Ornette Coleman and free jazz and like in 1959? I've always was curious about that. I wasn't sure if that was a period of time where he kind of disappeared.
Thanks for that question. So I think that in terms of the general public, they might classify Sonny Rollins as an inside player and Ornette Coleman as an outside player. But really, I would say they're part of the same lineage, part of the same continuum. I know that Sonny Rollins feels that way. And the question suggests another rumor that circulated around the time that Sonny took that break, that hiatus in 1959, which is that Ornette Coleman had arrived and made this big splash and was getting major press coverage. And Leonard Bernstein was freaking out about Ornette Coleman. And this is another factor that scared Sonny off. And he didn't know how to get with free jazz or with the avant-garde. But that, again, is far from the truth, which is that Sonny first met Ornette Coleman 2 years prior to that, in 1957. He met Don Cherry, too, when he went out to California and made the album Way Out West. He was there with Max Roach. And that record, Way Out West, some people think of it as the epitome of a certain kind of bop playing, but there's also a freedom to what he's doing on that album. And part of that is that he didn't play with a chordal instrument. There's no piano. It's just Shelly Mann and Ray Brown, the drummer and the bassist. And this is kind of what you hear on Ornette Coleman's The Shape of Jazz to Come. No chordal instrument. You just that group had no piano. But when Sonny went out to make Way Out West, he met Ornette Coleman and Don Cherry at that time. And he instantly recognized that Ornette was in that same lineage with Louis Armstrong and Charlie Parker. He heard it right away. And he spent a lot of time practicing with Ornette at that time. They would go out to Malibu and they'd play on the beach. Same with Don Cherry. And then later on, Sonny had Don Cherry and Billy Higgins in his band. And if you listen to his album, Our Man in Jazz, that's in a way his response to Ornette Coleman. But it's not one of hostility in any way. I mean, he absolutely just welcomed him with open arms. And late in the book, maybe around page 500 or 600, there is this moment when, you know, Ornette makes this remark about Sonny and Clifford Brown and Max Roach when they first heard Ornette Coleman, that they didn't approve of his music. And this really, the truth is that Ornette just kind of made a mistake at that time. And it wasn't Sonny who was there. Sonny, when he first heard Ornette, I mean, he loved it. So they had this close bond right away. And in 2010, they finally appeared together on stage in this cathartic, beautiful performance of Sunny Moon for Two. And they play this blues, and you can just hear, you can kind of hear that continuum and that friendship, you know, on this one track. And it was recorded. You can hear that on one of, they were called this Road Shows.
Road Shows Volume 3, I think.
Yeah.
And there's also, if you're interested in this area of sort of inspiration, one of my favorite documents of this is the 1963 Newport Jazz Festival, when Sonny invites his hero, Coleman Hawkins, to play with him. But, you know, his band had Paul Blay on piano at that time. And you hear them play, probably the most famous track from that set at Newport is All the Things You Are. And if you listen to what Sonny plays and what Coleman plays, you almost hear like Sonny's past and future, you know, on this one performance. And Blay, who of course played a lot with Ornette, is like right in the middle of that kind of weaving. It's a really incredible document.
Yeah, and also another thing I'd recommend is there's no commercial release for this, but you can seek it out. It is the extended run of Sonny's group that recorded that album Our Man in Jazz that I mentioned. So it's Don Cherry, Billy Higgins, and Bob Cranshaw. And they're playing at this club called The Village Gate. And if you seek that out, you can really hear kind of what that sounds like. That, and I would say also, yeah, Sonny Meets Hawk. Also, if you're interested in just the kind of shared heritage between these apparently different musical traditions, and just kind of how that plays out more broadly in the jazz continuum, I would strongly recommend everybody here to check out Nate's book, Playing Changes.
Oh.
yeah, so if you haven't already.
Sonny was very, very kind enough to be my first blurber on the book. And again, back to that spirit of generosity.
You had mentioned that at the end of this process, Sonny was having a hard time reading the manuscript or getting into it at first. Was there any point during the process where he was also kind of reluctant to share something or part with something? Was there anything that, like, maybe he was closely guarding or that was a little bit tougher to get out of him?
Yeah, it's a great question. It wasn't always easy to assess what maybe he didn't want to talk about as much. I mean, I know that in his early years, after he became a professional musician, he faced the drug epidemic. So, and that is something that he described as a scourge that afflicted all of his peers in Harlem at that time, when heroin swept through Harlem in about 1948. Like a tidal wave. And I go into some of the historical and cultural forces that led this generation of young people to get swept up in that wave. But I think that at first Sonny was reluctant to talk about that. It wasn't something that I was pushing for, because that's really not my focus in this book, but it is part of the story. And it is part of his spiritual journey as well. And one thing that I love about this story is that it's a story of overcoming some of those demons, that he did beat his addiction. He did voluntarily go to the public health service hospital in Lexington, Kentucky. And although they had a recidivism rate of about 95%, he didn't relapse through sheer force of will. He was almost an exception there, although I think a testament to the effectiveness of that program. But yeah, I don't know if Sonny likes to dwell on that period. I mean, who would really, especially when it's something that took place, you know, at this point about 70 years ago. But yeah, I think that over time, he realized that that aspect of the story could be inspirational to people. And after one of the reasons that he wanted to work so much on his mental, spiritual, physical health, especially in that 1959 sabbatical, was so that he could serve as a counterexample to young musicians and change the public perception of jazz so that people wouldn't identify it with the underworld or with addiction. And that's never how the musicians saw themselves, but Sonny wanted to make sure that he could serve as a positive example and use jazz as a positive force in the world. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's something that he was somewhat hesitant to talk about at first, but like I said, I think he came to realize that it's an important part of the story and it's not exclusive to Sonny Rollins, that this was a part of history and it's something that needed to be addressed. So I go into that in the book, as well as I said, the kind of overwhelming historical forces that contributed to that.
When you mentioned your access to the archives and the practice notes, I was wondering if you had insight on, and this is based on many conversations that I've had with colleagues, musicians, do you had insight on what we've noticed that what we consider an amazing trait of Sonny's, on Sonny Rollins, this ability that he had to actually pick songs in his repertoire that are very outside the standard repertoire. He has this ability to even find songs that are like from Broadway musicals that nobody even remembers. Mm-hmm. So do you have insight into that process?
Yeah, he would play songs like Tootsie or Rockabye or Baby with a Dixie melody, like these songs that who even had ever heard of these. So in terms of his practice notes, that wasn't there as much, although oftentimes he would buy sheet music for some of these popular tunes, that is, tunes from the Great American Songbook. And by that I mean, like, he would go to a music publisher and just pick up the piano music that maybe you might have in your house so that you could just sit down and plunk it out. Not like beginners, you know, just a, sort of like a lead sheet, but a little bit more complicated than what you might find on a lead sheet. And I know that he did play a little bit of piano. So there is that. In the practice notes, we see evidence of his approach to chord scale theory, like the way that a certain scale might correspond to a chord. And we see his emphasis on intervallic relationships, where he would be just working on patterns dealing with, let's say, originating in a musical phrase that emphasizes a sixth interval, something like that. Or his approach to the whole tone scale, he would just be doing whole tone patterns, and he would document this in his practice notes. But in terms of the unusual repertoire, that really goes back to his upbringing in Harlem and being a film buff, and listening to radio shows all the time, serial shows. So there's one song, Serenade by Drigo. That was the theme song to a radio show that he heard when he was a kid. And Way Out West came kind of out of his love for the Westerns. So he saw all those Westerns, and then there were other stars of the Westerns that he loved. Like one example would be Herb Jeffries, who was one of the only black stars in Western movies, and there was one called The Bronze Buckaroo. And if you think about The Bronze Buckaroo and you look at the cover to Way Out West, you'll make the connection instantly. So there's that there. Branford Marsalis has a quote about Sonny Rollins that if you want to play like Sonny Rollins, first you have to learn 10,000 songs.
I think that's a beautiful closing note for this conversation. Thank you all. Aidan will be upstairs. Books are available for sale. He will be signing them. And so we will see you up and away. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.